didn't understand, and it all seemed so in vain. Then she answered, yes, I found my happiness riding around in the rain. So, buddy, don't look for June nights.
Now, this is Harry Hughes, recording a little story from an old pioneer, Mr. Belzine, at my home at 215 6th in Fairbanks, Alaska, for Igloo 4, Pioneers of Alaska. Mr. Belzine, will you tell me your full name?
Jim Sadov Belzine.
How do you spell the name?
W-E-L-T-Z-I-N.
And you were going where, Mr. Belzine?
I was born on December 6th, 1883.
And where?
Down in Minnesota.
In Minnesota. And what brought you to Alaska?
Well, at that time I had no idea going to Alaska. But I went to Seattle. And when I got to Seattle, a fellow wanted me to go to Alaska. And there was three of us, and I decided there wasn't enough money for me to go to Alaska in the wintertime. This was back in 1907.
Do you remember the name?
Yeah, there was Andy. Well, I don't remember their names anymore. It's being forgotten years ago. So I give up the idea of going to Alaska, and I went streetcarring. I was a motorman on the streetcars for 3 years.
In Seattle?
In Seattle. Mm. And a fellow by the name of Emil Johnson, met him on a streetcar one night, going home. Asked him where he had been this summer. That was in 1909. Said, I've been up in Alaska all summer on Slate Creek. I said, when are you going back? He said, I'm going back after first of the year. I said, I'm with you. And we went on February 1st. We landed in Valdez. We stayed there for about 3 weeks. And then we hired out in the Gray's Copper Mine, that was 165 miles into Copper Mountain. And I didn't like it up there and stayed only a short time. I walked from there again 65 miles down to Copper River Railroad. And down there I got sick. I had a bad cold from 1st of April. Middle of June I was ordered out of there while I was able to walk. So we decided to walk into Fairbanks, which was 365 miles. And the next night we were on the trail. We made that trip in 11 days. We stayed in Fairbanks a couple of days. Then we decided to go out on the creeks.
And we walked. Can you tell us a little bit now on the Valdez Trail, what you found when you walked up the Valdez Trail?
Well,
starting from Valdez?
From Valdez, why, that was in the wintertime. And
you travel on snowshoes?
No, on foot. And we made that trip in about a week's time. And nothing but hardship. My feet swelled. And we got to one roadhouse one night. Somebody said, well, take off your shoes and run outside in the snow. Which we did. We'd run around the roadhouse barefooted, 35 below zero. But we made that all right. And the trouble was when we come into Fairbanks over the trail, there was no bridges. And we had to cross so many streams. And we were soaked wet night and day for 3 days. And we never met any wild animals of any kind. Never seen a wild animal on the whole trip. And them days, there was no road. It was just bare foot trail.
Do you remember the names of any places, the roadhouses that were established in that time when you come in?
Well, it's, I remember some of them, but it's been so many years since I come over that trail that I forgot most of them. I don't remember what's.
Was there a roadhouse near where Paxton Lodge is today?
Well, yes, in Town Cena. I remember Town Cena Roadhouse. Jake Knapp's that run that. That was out of Valdez about 60 miles. And then I don't remember the names of the others. Didn't stay much at the roadhouse.
And the next roadhouses after that, where were they?
Well, there was lots of them, you see, about 20 miles. We stayed at one there at what they call the Yost place. We had quite a time crossing the big delta and the little delta.
When you got across the country coming out of Black Rapids, do you remember Beale's Cache?
Yeah, I remember Beale's Cache, yeah.
What can you tell us about that?
Well, you know, you don't get to see much when you only stay overnight. Of course, we walked at night and slept in the daytime.
It was easier going to walk at night?
Oh, yeah, it was cooler. It wasn't so hot. That's the reason we walked at night. Some days we made as high as 42 miles a day. Some days we dropped down to about 25 miles a day. But our average walking was 33 miles a day.
Well, then there was some place to stop normally, or did you camp out?
We camped out outside of, if it was raining, wet while we stayed in the roadhouse. Outside of that, we camped outside.
Now, what did you pack on you as equipment to come over the trail?
Well, we had our bedding with us and a certain amount of grub. But there's one thing we never packed with us. We never had a gun.
You never carried a gun?
Never carried a gun.
Well, that's an odd thing in those early days, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Of course, them days, they're different than they are nowadays. A man has got to pack a gun or wants to pack a gun wherever he goes. Them days, we never thought about packing a gun unless we went out hunting.
Unless you needed to get something to eat.
Yeah, get something to eat. Otherwise, we never packed a gun.
Well, in coming over the trail, do you remember anyone that was lost or in trouble on the trail or any incidents?
No. Everything seems to be normal. You meet people going one way and going out or going back to Valdez or different places. But there wasn't many going over the trail at that time of the year. Most of the traveling was done in the wintertime. Because when the transportation closed, the riverboats closed, shut down for the winter, while the only way to get to the States was to go over the trail to Valdez.
Do you remember who was running dog teams over the trail that time?
Well, I didn't remember any of them because I never met a man with a dog team, because it was in the summertime. Never met a man with any dogs. Mm-hmm. It is unusual for a person to walk over the trail in the summer. Most of them take a boat. Mm-hmm. But being down on the Copper River Railroad, we'd either have to go to Cordova and catch a boat going around by St. Michael's, or go back to Skagway and then go up White Pass into White Horse and around by Dawson. Mm-hmm. And we figured we'd make better time by hiking it over the trail, which we did. The only trouble we had was a lot of mosquitoes. Never had a mosquito net. That is the only trouble we had on the whole trail, outside of fording these streams, which was tough at times. Didn't know whether to see the other side or not. And I said at that time, if I ever made a trip again, two of us, we'd have a long rope. So one fella get across while he can take the other one across. Mm-hmm. But I'll never make another trip like that, at least I hope not.
Well, then you come on into what is now Fairbanks.
Fairbanks.
What was here when you first landed, the first few days you're here? What did you notice the most?
Well, there wasn't much. The business section was on Front Street for about 5 blocks. When you got in on Second, you were practically in the back street them days.
And then did you stay in town or what did you work at?
I stayed in town for a couple of days and then we hiked over to Pedro and up over the hill into Dome Creek. Then I went to work for Walter Fisher underground. Mm-hmm. First underground work I'd done in my life. That was in last part of June, 1910.
What kind of a mine was that?
Yeah, it was placer mining. A 168 feet deep.
You'd haul the stuff out in buckets and...
Haul it out in buckets and had wheelbarrows, but down below, shovel into a wheelbarrow and then dump it in the bucket.
And that was on Dome Creek?
That was on Dome, what they call the Niggerhead Flats.
Mm-hmm. Was this Walter Fisher any relation to Grace Fisher here, to your knowledge?
Yeah, brother of Grace Fisher.
Mm-hmm.
He also had another brother by the name of Frank that was on the mine at that time.
Frank Fisher?
Yeah, Frank Fisher. Then I went over to Goldstream, and I worked for Hutch Williams for that summer. And that winter, six of us went in, took a lay on Pedro, six below Pedro. We mined that winter, and very poor ground. And I was trying to tell these fellas there was nothing in it, and they were trying to tell me they had mined for years. They knew more about it than I did, so I had to keep quiet. When spring come, they found out I was right. They figured a dollar and a quarter to a dollar and a half a foot, and all we got out of it was 40 cents a foot, paid up 25% royalty, and come out for $200 for 8 months' work.
That wasn't very much money, was it?
No, very little money for the work we done. We worked 10 hours on the ground, sawed wood, rustled water, and...
In those days, did they furnish you the grub, or did you have to furnish your own grub?
You had to furnish, we bought our own grub. We were in partners, there's six of us. We bought the grub from E.R. Peoples and Johnson here on 2nd Avenue, where Nordell is located today. The only ones that was willing to trust us. We paid $100 apiece in the fall. We got the grub for the same price all winter, what we agreed on. We told them in the spring, when we had the cleanup, to come out and get their money. They took a chance on it and waited until the last day before we got off the claim. From then on, my credit was always good in Fairbanks. Then in 1912, I got married here. 1915, I bought a store on on Little El Dorado. And between the store and Fallen Mining. Later on, I made a store up in Chanig, and I had that for a number of years.
Describe where Little El Dorado is.
Well, El Dorado was booming them days.
The location of it?
The location is 25 miles out of Fairbanks, or 2 miles west of Chattanooga. There was quite a few mining them days. No trouble seeing 200 or 300 miners in evenings coming down to the little town of El Dorado. When it died out, I had a store in Chattanooga. And when that died down, I moved over to Fairbanks Creek.
Well, what year did you leave Chattanooga?
I left Chattanooga in 39. Went over to Fairbanks Creek. Built a store over there. Worked for the FE Company. I sold out in 52.
Who bought you out?
Martin Sater, Jr. He's got it to today.
Is there anyone living over in that country today that was there when you first went in there?
No. Both the old town and all these towns, Little El Dorado, Chattanooga, and Fairbanks Creek, it's all gone as far as... There's only two or three living in Chattanooga, and they're newcomers. All the old-timers is dead and gone, most of them.
Now, Mr. Welding, what do you remember about the activities here for entertainment? What did you do for entertainment in the early days?
Well, in the early days, on the creeks, we had better time than they have today. There at El Dorado, we decided to have a little community between ourselves. One Christmas, the first Christmas I spent in El Dorado, after I got married, my wife and Mrs. Fred Myers, they decided to collect $3 apiece from each one on the creek that winter for a Christmas feed. We went into an old building, used to be a saloon. We had our dinner there and had a phonograph. We had cards, we played cards for a while and get up and dance for a while, played a phonograph. And then we had something to eat. And 4 o'clock in the morning, why, we left for home and said, well, we've still got quite a bit of grub left. What we're short of, well, someone will bring it and we'll come back. We'll come back again this afternoon. So we decided to come back that afternoon. First thing we knew, we had people coming from Homeless and Chattanooga there. And we kept that up for 9 days without a let up.
9 days celebration.
9 days and nine nights celebration, which we call a good time. And from then on, when they moved that building out of there, tore it down, we got into another one. We planed the floor and sandpapered it. We had that for a number of times. When that was torn down, we got into another old building, put in a brand new floor, polished it all up, and we had people coming there for dances pretty near every week. Pete Pearson, he used to come down there with an accordion, and he surely knew how to play it. Any new record come out, he turned around, turned the phonograph on, next dance, why, he had that already.
He learned to play from the records?
He learned to play from the records.
Oh, that was a good way.
And all the women say, well, Pete, will you play this one? All right. Next dance, another woman say, well, can you play this, Pete? He said, all right. It wasn't anything that he couldn't play. They surely had a good time there for a number of years until things died down one place and then the other.
Well, what caused them to die out? Mostly the no profit in the mining?
Well, mining, the underground, most of them is all gone. No way of making any more money. Then they moved to other camps. And when I was up in Chattanooga there, they had a big dance hall up there. We had that for a good many years. Until the FE, U.S. Smelting, Refining and Mining Company, started to work, why, everything had to be tore down. That was on the mining ground. So from them days, it's been pretty quiet on the creeks. There hasn't been much social events going on.
Well, actually, machinery mining didn't do the miners and the people living here in the country too much good.
No, it didn't.
It retarded the economy.
Yeah.
Because all the money goes out of here.
Yeah.
Now, what was your wife's name when you married her?
Well, her name was Martha Johnson. She came up from Seattle in 1912, and we got married in Fairbanks here. Those days, we didn't need a license. All we had to do was go and get married.
The good commissioner or the preacher?
Well, we had a preacher come to the Norddale Hotel. We got married in the Norddale Hotel.
And that's on the river, when the Norddale was on the river?
Yeah, on the river, mm-hmm. First Avenue. And they didn't get no marriage license in here, as near as I remember, until 1916. This was back in 1912.
Well, now, Jack Brooks was in here around 1910, 11, and 12, and he was on the council one time. Do you remember about him?
No, I didn't remember many of them in Fairbanks outside of the business people, because...
Well, you remember Pinska and...
oh, yes, I remember
Carr.
Remember Pinska and...
Jim Berrick
and... And Coleman, George Coleman, he was the head of the NC them days. That's a good many years ago. And Bob Bloom, knew him. And Knoppy, knew him, had a restaurant here. And Berglund. And also Bentley's, Kramer's. Well, I knew all the business people, Norddale's. And different ones here, there's quite a few saloons. Of course, I didn't know many of those. John Moe, I knew him. He had a saloon on Fort and Cushman's. He was practically out of Fairbanks at that time, because Second Avenue is in the back street.
Well, you've seen quite a change in this country in these last 55, 60 years, haven't you?
Yes, I spent 52 years here. I stayed 41 years before I made a trip back to the States.
Well, you broke my record by 3 times.
Yeah. And I surely enjoyed the trip. I hadn't been back home since 1908. That was my first trip in 1951.
Now, do you have some relation alive that you go to see?
Oh, yes. I've got so many relations, it takes me a month to see them all.
Oh, I see. What locality are they in? Are they brothers and sisters? Can you give two or three names on here?
Well, my oldest brother, he lives in Minneapolis. My youngest sister and her husband lives in Minneapolis. And I've got a lot of nieces and nephews. I got a sister in Starbuck, Minnesota. I got a sister at Donnelly, Minnesota. I got a brother in Golandale, Washington. I got a brother in Palo Alto, California. I got a sister in Pasadena. I got a sister in Denver. There was 11 children in our family. And there are 9 of us still living.
And you're planning on a trip out to visit them again this?
I'm planning a trip out next Tuesday. I'm planning a trip out to Seattle, where I got my home. May come back next summer to do a little traveling. But as far as I know now, I think I'll retire.
You'll retire on Social Security and...
Social Security and can live the rest of my life. I'm getting up in years now, and I think I'm entitled to retirement.
You joined the Pioneers of Alaska here in what year?
I joined them in March 1937. I took out life membership in 1948.
You're a life member of Igloo 4. Do you belong to the Yukon Order Pioneers of Dawson?
No, I don't. I belong to the Yukon Pioneers in Seattle.
That's called the Alaska Yukon Pioneers.
Yeah.
There's quite a large membership down there here. Do you have any idea about the size of the organization?
Well, no. I joined them last fall, and I didn't really find out, but it's pretty big.
There's several hundred of them.
Yeah, there is several hundred. Of course, they're scattered all over. Some is still up here, and some is in California. But there's quite a few. The old-timers, when I go out there, I meet them in Seattle.
Well, that's a home away from home, when you get away from Alaska.
Yeah. It's just my second home.
Mm-hmm.
After being there, I street guy there for 3 years, it is just the same as home to me.
Well, you've seen the Seattle grow from the early days, too, then.
Oh, yeah. Seattle was only about 80,000 when I was first come to Seattle in 1906. So there's been a lot of changes, both in Seattle and up here.
Well, they were logging right down close to Seattle in those years.
Yeah.
Between there and Tacoma.
Yeah.
And up towards Everett and that Mufflefield, that district.
That was all vacant. Mm-hmm. I could have bought lots out at Woodland Park back in 1907 for $250. In 3 years' time, they were selling for $3,000. And I don't know today, I guess they're selling for about $30,000.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, everything has changed.
Everything has changed. Both here and there.
Well, this is Harry Hughes, recording for Igloo 4, and I want to thank you for this little bit on tape, and I'm going to play it back so you can hear it. And this will go into the Pioneer Tapes for preservation of Pioneer history here.
Well, that'll be fine, Mr. Hughes. Glad to have this done.
This is October the 22nd, 1961 at Fairbanks, Alaska.
Thank you. is October the 22nd, 1961, Fairbanks, Alaska. This is Harry Hughes and Frank Young at the home of Mr. Porcupile at 320 Farewell Avenue, Hamilton Acres. It's Sunday afternoon, and Mr. Porcupile is going to talk and converse with those for the Pioneer History on this tape recording.
This is Harris Edward Porcupile. I was born in Michigan, 8th July, 1883. And we moved, our family moved to Nebraska about 3 or 4 years later after I was born. And my father farmed there for about 6 or 7 years. And then we moved to Seattle, where I got my formal schooling. And in 1904, I came to Alaska. I first landed off this ship in Solomon. I didn't get off at Norman the first time. I went to Solomon, and I got a job there at Technical Camp. I took all that summer for a question. And then towards the fall, or towards the end of the summer 1904, I came back to Norman, and there was a big excitement on the beach. I mean, the third beach had been struck, and I tried to get in on a tour. So there was an old man there that had taken quite a fancy to me. I don't know why, but anyway, in fact, he wanted me to live with him and be his son. He had just lost a son, just about my age. And he offered to stoke me. He said, I got a lot of claims out there on the third beach line. And he says, I'll stoke you, and it'll be 50-50. And so he hired a man, and he purchased all the materials, water and everything, and another man, we went out there. Well, as it happened, the third beach was getting pretty well started towards that, towards the end of the summer. And there were camps going up as far as you could see along the third beach. But his property laid west around the creek. And as it happens after, we were found out that hard way, that the third beach line didn't extend west past the Anglo creek. And we were unlucky to have those claims just there. And anyway, we worked there all winter. In fact, I went back up as north at another river there. And we sent deep holes we didn't. And we come to find out and had the displays made, we'd been sinking past the level of the third beach. So the third beach line, wherever the pay was always on the same level. And finally discovered that it had all been washed out with Snake River. And when that part came out of Snake River, like it was in the article the other day, it was back about, well, 3 miles, I think it was, from the present beach, the third beach line was. But anyway, there were many of them. It was on the coast loop, but the space loop extended for about 6 miles, I guess, the third beach. There was many fortunes made there. In fact, Brown, I forget his first name now, just made the discovery. We called him Little Creek Brown, because it was Little Creek that we first made that discovery. He got $1,000 pans. He didn't get it at first, but then when he got into the hell of a taste, as it happens, it was not like most taste beaks, the state beaks, that is concentrated in the waves. It was concentrated right down to a hard bedrock. It was a hard clay sand bedrock. And there's places there that there's a quarter of an inch of gold lying right on this hard bedrock. And of course it is easy to scrape that out and get those $1,000 pans. arrive at the second side of this tape, and Mr. Porcupine will continue with this part of the story, and Frank Young will question him or interview him about this tape.
Mr. Porcupine, you speak of the third boots and the fourth boots. Could you give it to us briefly what you mean by the fourth boots?
Well, during periods of time, way back, we don't know just how long it was back, the Bering Sea was, instead of being at the present beach, was up at the fourth beach, and it concentrated the pay street there. And then as the sea receded, it concentrated what we call the third beach. That is the richest beach, and probably one of the richest pay streets that ever found in the world. And just why that most of this gold should have been found on the third beach is still a question among many. Well, we come to what we call the intermediate beach. I never mind on the intermediate, but my partners did, I took in afterwards. And it was not anywhere near as rich as the third beach. It was about a mile closer to the sea than the third beach. And then from there, we go down to what they call the second beach. And that second beach is about, I understand that this beaches were formed as the ocean or the sea receded. And of course, it's probably each one probably took up thousands of years at each place. And then the second beach was the third, was the first inland beach found. That is, it was about somewhere around a half a mile back of the present beach. Well, then we had what we call a submarine beach. And that submarine was only about, somewhere not over a quarter of a mile back from the present beach. And it was deep, very deep. It was much deeper than the others. And no big fortunes were made on it, but there was much gold taken out of what they call the submarine beach. They call it the submarine because it was way down below the present beach, and how that formed is for somebody else to figure out. And then the present beach where that started the gold rush to Nome was worked out early. It was even worked out before I came there. It didn't take long to work them out because they had their miners' meetings and there when they first come in, and they decided that each person would only have so much on this. Some of them was only about 10 or 12 feet wide from the back of the beach to the water, and many of them would take out $2,000 or $3,000 just in that little strip. And it was shallow, and it was hard to work too because there was so much fine gold in it, and many of them made cloth or riffles out of old gunny sacks and old quilts or old woolen blankets, which served well to save the fine gold. Well, anyway, they began prospecting again. You ask how these beaches come. A bunch of the miners that started to figure, maybe there's some money back of this first beach, and they started sinking holes, and they found this second beach, and it was never rich. It was a kind of a wedge proposition. Nobody ever found much on it. Now, is any other questions you'd want to? Is that the?
Well, that was very interesting. To explain those beaches to us. Now you can go ahead with your story, Mr.
Where did I leave off? Just a minute.
We're coming back to where I was talking about the third beach. Well,
We worked there all winter. That was the winter of 1904 and 1905, and we finally discovered that it had been washed out by Snake River. Well, speaking about this third beach, the most why the pans were so large, from the action of the ocean at that time, it's easily to see why it concentrated it more than what a creek would. The waves going back and forth, it concentrated it right down on a hard bedrock, and that's why the big pans, you'd get them right on bedrock. There's many fortunes made in along that third beach. After we got through prospecting there, where Mr. Obam, I don't know whether I asked him or he suggested it, I don't remember now. He says, if you want to go into some business, I'll stake you. So I knew something about cooking and one thing or another, and I didn't know too much about restaurant business, but I thought I did. So he staked me to start up a cafe in Nome, and we expected a big rush still coming in, and I thought, well, it looked pretty good, so I opened up a cafe, and I had probably the highest class bill for it in Nome. In fact, I went at it too big instead of feeling my way along, and before the summer's over, I was broke, and the big rush never showed up that we expected. So I went on after that. I went back to Solomon, where I first landed, and took a job down there and worked around there for a year, around Solomon River. And then in the summer of 1906, during about the middle of summer, I went to... I went to Deering to work on the Fairhaven Ditch. They were building a ditch there then, the Fairhaven Mining Company. And I worked there for about 2 weeks on that ditch, and it was a kind of a slave driving job. And I says to another fellow, I says, let's go out prospecting. He says, I'm with you. So we knew that we weren't too far from Candle, about probably 40 miles. So we didn't even draw our pay. We just got some supplies from the cook, and we started out across country, went over across the Kugaruk River and down the Kukuru River. And there we met an old fellow, or two fellows, in a wagon. They were out there staking claims on the Kugaruk River, and they asked us if we wanted to ride into Candle, where we were going. And said, that's where we were intended to go. So we got a ride from there on into Candle, and this fellow that was with me, his name was I forget his name now, Willis, anyhow he called him, Bill Willis. We got a job there shoveling in up on Candle Creek on one of the benches there, and we worked there for about 2 weeks. And then I went down to Kewalik, and we longshored there a while, and then we went back to Candle and to see if we could get another job there. And he got a job hauling coal from the coal mine. And there's a coal mine on the Kugaruk River supplying coal for the Candle Creek.
But as it happened, we were right there during the first election of delegates to Alaska. It was Frank Waskey was running for the short term, and Thomas Keel was running for the second term. And I knew Frank Waskey personally, but I didn't know Thomas Cayley was a Fairbanks man. Anyway, that's where I put my first boat in, at Candle. Now this might be interesting about that railroad. Now, when I come back in the towards fall back to Nome, they were just building that railroad and they just got it finished. Would that be of any interest?
Mr. Porcupine, to get back to mining on the beaches of Nome, I'd like to ask you this question, which might sound a little foolish, one old timer asking another. But there's people, including myself, that sometimes wonders, where did that gold come from? I mean to say, you speak of the beaches, did it come from the creeks and come down the creeks into the ocean, or to the sea rather, and then from there the sea took over and washed it up on the beaches, or was it in the ocean? Where do you think it come from?
No, I don't think it came from the ocean. We found there in places where we were mining little stringers of quartz with gold in it. And all the way from Anvil Mountain down to the beach, every once in a while, where men would be mining, they'd run across these little stringers in bedrock. And now, the action of the waves over all that time would wash these, naturally wash these stringers out, and that's where the gold came from. Of course, some of it come down from Anvil Mountain, because Anvil Creek itself was a very rich creek. There's millions of dollars come out of Anvil Creek alone. In fact, I think there was 2 or 3 million come out of just one claim. That's a Japhet Lindbergh's claim, the one that first discovered the gold there.
That was the discoverer of gold there, wasn't it?
That they, of course they found it on the beach first, and then Japhet Lindbergh, there was 3 of them, I don't know, Lindboom, and I forget now, there was 3 of them. They were Laplander herders, and they come over from St. Michael's. It seems like that they had heard something about some gold being on the beach at Nome, and they left this Rames herd and beat it for Nome. And they happened to be the first ones there. And it looks like it seems to me, as I used to hear the stories, that the first fellow that found the, we never hear much about him, the first fellow that found beach gold on the beach. But anyway, when these Laplanders got off of it, well, they went to Nome in a hurry and started prospecting on the creeks, and they, of course, they didn't have to go far back to Anvil Creek, where it enters the hills. It is easy to prospect. Now, further down in the flats, of course, they wouldn't get the gold because it is deep, and that's where they first found it. Well, that is from that was about 19. I don't know just the date, but it must have been around about 1898 or 1899. Well, then there wasn't any more big strike after that till a third beach line was struck, which I mentioned before. Of course, Anvil Creek was the richest creek of the creeks, but there were 2 other creeks that were very rich. There was Dexter Creek, named after Dexter. I think his name was John Dexter, one of the first pioneers there. And then there was Glazer Creek. Glazer Creek and Dexter Creek, they just headed into each other. Dexter Creek ran in the Nome River, and Glazer Creek ran in the Snake River. But neither one of these creeks, although they were very rich, they were not as rich as Anvil Creek. And in fact, as I mentioned before, none of them was rich as the third beach line. As any other?
No, that's very interesting to know, Mr. Porcupile.
As
Yeah, that fellow's name was John Dexter. I remember that. He's got many offspring living around there yet.
Well, now, what do you remember about the villages? You come in 1984. What do you remember about the natives and the villages there, the way of life?
Well, when I first came to Nome, there weren't too many. In fact, natives there. I think the nearest native village was what they call Sinrock or Sinrock. There was a big village there. But the natives came to Nome to sell their wares, their skins, and ivory and stuff
like
that.
But they were Eskimos, not Indians.
They were pure Eskimos. Hardly any breeds at all. They were just pure Eskimos. All Eskimos.
You were there during the high waters and the floods in Nome in 1908,
1911? I was, yeah. I remember I was there, and they washed out quite a few buildings on Front Street that was on the seaside. But they repaired them up again, and then at... when the fire came along, that was the big fire. Well, there was, I think there was two or three fires. There was one in fact, there was one fire in 1905 that gutted one side of Front Street. In fact, it took away that restaurant that I had been in. Although I'd walked off from it and I didn't own it anymore, but it burnt that up. I'd have lost it anyhow if I'd been there. And then there were several other fires that took quite a bit of the town. But the big fire that just wiped Nome out was in 1934. I'd just been there that summer. I was attending a school of the teachers there in Nome that summer of 1934. And when we got back home, we heard about the Nome was wiped out. It seems like there was a big breeze came along and they just swept it. They didn't have a chance. The wind was too high, they couldn't.
Now will you drift on and tell us about how you come to be a teacher at Nome and what you encountered when you became a teacher there and some of the life that you had as a teacher?
Well, my wife and I, shortly after we were married,
you give her full name on the tape.
What?
Give her full name on the tape.
Sarah Whitehead. Sarah E. Whitehead is the woman I married. We're getting, I guess, ahead of my story. It was we were married in Nome in 1919, but I met her in Candle. I'd known her there for about 2 years, and then after night we went outside. It was the fall of 1919, and we were out for quite a few years. But before that, I had sold this quartz mine for a large sum of money and thought that I was sitting pretty. But when the year came up, at the end of the year, they refused to make any more payments. And so I was left high and dry with the family started, and I had to go to work out there. So I went to work in the Navy Yard there for a year. When I
That is Bremerton.
Yes. Well, then after we were out there, I worked around different places. We would come back, and I was going to open up the quartz mine again, and I had a job there with the T. Wallach Mining Company as a master mechanic, and we stayed there three years. My wife got the postmastership, but before going back, before we left Seattle, we had put our names in. I put our applications in for school teachers in the, it was Alaska Bureau of Education at that time. Well, a fellow by the name of Lopp was the head of it then. And But the second time we went around to visit him, we had these two babies with us. The oldest was Muriel and Norma. And he says, I can't send you with those babies. So we thought, well, that's all off. In fact, he had a job that he had teaching in the Cresco Quim. He had that just about ready to send us there. But anyway, I said, let's go back to Candle. So we went back to Candle. And we were there then from 1925 to 1928. And the superintendent, we forgot all about this application that we put into school. We thought it was a dead issue. But the superintendent of schools, George A. Morlander, came and made a trip to Candle and asked us if we wanted to teach. So we asked all the particulars, and he says, I've got one school opening, and I can't get any teachers to go there. He says, it's been a hard school, and out of the whole 11, it's the hardest school. It's one of the largest schools. I think it's the second largest to Point Barrow. And he says, if you take it for 1 year, I'll move you to another school. So we agreed to take the school for 1 year. And so we left in the fall. We went from Candle and moved everything, went around by Kotzebue and up through the Kobuk Lake and up into Selwick Lake, and Selwick village itself is situated about 12 miles from the mouth of the river, the mouth of Selwick River. And we arrived there sometime in early September, I think it was. And the Eskimos gave us a good reception there.
Do you remember any of the names of the school teachers that were up there? Do you remember Mrs. Brown?
No.
Lives in Fergin, Washington now. She taught school up in that area.
I don't remember.
Howard Brown's mother. You know Howard Brown, the sheet metal man there?
No.
She's told me some.
Oh.
I bet you do.
Howard Brown, no, I don't know. I just think it's about Howard Brown, but I don't know him too well, but I know him when I see him. He belongs to the Eagle there, doesn't
yeah.
he? Yeah, yeah. In fact, he was in one of the offices there for a while, wasn't
mm-hmm.
he? Then he moved to Nome, and then he come back?
Yeah, his mother taught school in Nome when he was a small child.
Oh,
around the time that you were there.
Oh,
Back in the 20s, 18 and 20. 1918 to 20, 22 or 23, around in there.
Well, I knew several Browns in Nome. I knew this Brown, what we call a Little Creek Brown. In fact, I never got his name.
We'll have to terminate this tape and start on tape number 2. No. And you'll continue about the teachers.
Well, the only teachers that I remember that preceded us, one was Schoenfeld and Hazen, and then the first teacher that built the school, I forgot his name now, the first teacher the school was built in 1908, and those boys that went to the first school were men then, when we arrived there. And we